You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
There's no doubt some women and men have debilitating sexual difficulties that require medical explanation and effective treatment. But this is very different from corporate-sponsored creation of a disease labeled female sexual dysfunction, claiming to afflict massive numbers of women, which urgently needs a drug cure. Barbara Mintzes is co-author of the book Sex, Lies, and Pharmaceuticals that explains the process of creation of a female illness that will provide a mass market for drugs, paralleling the success of marketing Viagra to men. Barbara Mintzes is an assistant professor in the UBC Department of Anesthesiology, Pharmacology, and Therapeutics. She spoke with Mordecai earlier this week, and he began by asking her how the pharmaceutical industry generated the idea of female sexual dysfunction.
Well, they were involved in every step in the process in defining female sexual dysfunction as a new kind of medical condition. The first step was at a conference in Cape Cod in 1997, which was sponsored by a group of pharmaceutical companies and included, I think it was 19 sort of expert sex researchers, key opinion leaders in the field. 18 of the 19 had very strong financial ties to the pharmaceutical industry. And the companies were in... Employees of the companies were also involved in the discussions directly in terms of defining the condition. You can then move on to how do you define how often it occurs. And this was, there was a study published in 1999 in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which is a very, you know, one of the most prestigious medical journals. And it's been cited about 1,000 times, which is, you know, any academic would know that you'd be very happy to have any of your papers cited 1,000 times. That study actually claims a 43% prevalence, so a 43% rate of female sexual dysfunction. Almost half of women have this condition. And they... So they've done this in a way with by asking very general questions which had yes-no responses of any time in the last year. Have you, for few months, been less interested in sex than usual? Have you had, you know, other difficulties with sex? There were a series of 7 questions. Did you climax too quickly, which is an odd question for women, or did you have trouble having orgasms, you know, or did you have pain on intercourse? And I'm trying to remember, you know, I can remember the series of about 7 questions. If you said yes to any one of these questions, you then went into the pot of having female sexual dysfunction. And there's a very small disclaimer in the article that this is not a clinical diagnosis of, you know, a person actually having a sexual problem that needs to be treated. But the way that that figure has then been used since is... has it's been cited a lot that there's this huge mass of women out there needing treatment. So I guess that's a second step, is define it as in terms of having a huge unmet need.
And is there also a diagnostic tool beyond the survey, which also is part of the pharmaceutical effort to identify, convince people that large numbers are in this condition of dysfunction, and therefore some pharmaceutical device could be the solution to that problem?
So there have been a number of questionnaires developed and actually developed by the companies for their clinical trials. So yes, they've been very involved in the developing of the question of, you know, of questionnaires, and also funding, for instance, a simple screening tool that doctors might use. Now, I think what you need to look at with this is how does it relate to sort of to people's lives in general and the context in which they might experience some sexual problems. Because if you're measuring something in a way where you're defining it as purely physical, as physical and individual and something that might respond to drug treatment, what you've left out of the equation, for instance, you know, if you go back to that question of in the last year, did a woman have, you know, a couple of months or a period of time when she was less interested in sex? There's no question about what else was going on in her life. You know, was she grieving at the time? Was she in a relationship that was going incredibly badly? There are all kinds of reasons that in a person's life that can affect their feelings about sex as well.
So this process then of trying to identify an illness and in a sense create the notion of an illness in order to be able to market a pharmaceutical, is this just one of many examples where that occurs?
Yeah, I would say yes. Certainly there's pharmaceutical companies have become more and more involved in defining diseases and in many times in stretching the boundaries of disease. You know, in this particular case, what's interesting is you had three different types of drugs that have been tried out for female sexual problems and that have very different mechanisms of action. They have very different ways that they work in the body. So to begin with, the first was Viagra. That, you know, Viagra was a huge seller in terms of the male market, and the Pfizer, its manufacturer, was interested in seeing whether it would also work for women. And when it was being tested, then you had a lot of discussion about women's sexual problems being related to lack of blood flow to the genitals, you know, inadequate blood flow. And that's because the way that Viagra works is by increasing blood flow. So Viagra didn't work at all for women. It's, you know, it doesn't really distinguish itself from a placebo or sugar pill. So then the next drug that's been tried is a testosterone patch. And you had then a lot of discussion about, you know, hormonal problems being the basis for women's sexual problems. And the testosterone patch, the manufacturer tried to get it approved in the United States, and the FDA didn't approve it. And that's because partly it was very ineffective. The difference to placebo was not very big. And then also there were serious concerns about harm, about increased rates of heart attack and of cancers that could occur, especially with long-term use. So it was another failure. And then you've had most recently you've had actually an antidepressant being tried for female sexual dysfunction, a drug called flibanserin, which had been tested originally as an antidepressant and didn't work very well. And we then had all of this sort of press coverage about how sexual problems among women are a brain chemistry problem. So, you know, this one as well, this is a drug that was developed by a German company, Boehringer Ingelheim. It came before an FDA advisory committee on its way to being, you know, they'd been submitted for approval in the US, and it was refused because it was so ineffective. But what was interesting is the enormous amount of press coverage that the so-called pink Viagra that came out before that advisory committee met. So a very large marketing machine in terms of getting this drug out. But I think I haven't really answered your question. I've answered it about about this specific disease.
But you could take any diseases then in the same model where you expand the boundaries of it, and it's not really a condition urgently in need of any kind of pharmaceutical treatment.
Well, for instance, you can certainly... So there's a few things that are going on in terms of... Definitely, pharmaceutical companies have been very involved in sort of in disease definitions and also diagnostic tools and measurements to see whether a person has a condition or not. And, you know, what we've seen is also a shift with the market into these blockbuster drugs, where the companies will have their, you know, a few products that they're depending on enormous sales for. The problem is that there's just a limited number of sick people out there. So if you can market your drug to a healthier population, then you have a lot larger potential market. And we've seen situations like the shift in thresholds for things like hypertension, high blood pressure, or high cholesterol, where you've got, if you lower the threshold, then you define a lot more people as needing treatment. And that's certainly happened with the cholesterol, with high cholesterol, for instance. The other side, which is another example with high cholesterol, is if you define a risk factor as though it's actually a disease, then you can also convince a lot more people to take treatment. So, for instance, cholesterol itself is a healthy part of the human body. It becomes a problem, having too high a cholesterol level becomes a problem, particularly in people at high risk of heart disease, because it's one risk factor among another for heart disease. For women who have not had a heart attack before, for instance, there's no reason to ever get your cholesterol tested and treated, because there is an evidence that the benefits outweigh the harm in terms of taking a drug treatment for that. Other example would be something like osteoporosis, which used to be defined as a disease of fractures, fragility fractures, became redefined as in terms of bone density. And then there's a test, a bone density test. And if a person's bone density is too low, they can take a drug to increase their bone density. What they're treating is a risk factor. It only makes sense if it'll actually decrease the rate of fractures later on. So a whole range of situations where... and certainly when you get to psychiatry, massive problem in terms of people who've been involved in defining the conditions also having very strong ties financially to the manufacturers of the drugs that are used to treat those conditions. So, you know, that's a massive problem as well.
And that interview with Professor Barbara Mintzes was taped earlier this week. She is a co-author of the new book, Sex, Lies, and Pharmaceuticals, available at the UBC bookstore. Barbara Mintzes is assistant professor in the Department of Anesthesiology, Pharmacology, and Therapeutics at the University of British Columbia.